The Cosmic Conflict, Commentary for the March 1st, 2025 Sabbath School Lesson by Stephen Terry, Director, Stillwaters Ministry, www.visitstillwaters.com. Then war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back. But he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. He was hurled to the earth, and his angels with him. Revelation 12, verses 7 through 9. The story of Jesus' life here on earth begins with his incarnation and the miraculous events surrounding that birth. Then, except for a single Passover incident while visiting the temple in Jerusalem, mentioned by Luke, the scriptures are silent about what happened to Jesus over the 3 decades when he grew from a child to a man. There are other sources that seek to unveil this period, the most notable being the Gospel according to Thomas. However, none of these sources found their way into our present biblical canon. While there is not universal agreement even today on the canon of the Old Testament, Christianity by and large has accepted the canon for the New Testament established by the Roman Catholic Church in the late 4th century of the Common Era. The Eastern Orthodox Church came into agreement with that canon by including the book of Revelation in the following century. This may be problematic for Protestants who claim they adhere to the doctrine of sola scriptura, the Bible as a sole authority for faith and practice. In response, our Catholic friends might ask, and who determined what was in that Bible? Of course, the answer to that is the Catholic Church, most notably at the Council of Trent. They may go on logically to say that since a church determines what is in the Bible, then the church is the ultimate authority, even over the Bible. Protestants, on the other hand, might rejoin that God preserved the inspired scriptures despite the efforts of councils and prelates to undermine his will. In any event, most traditions use the same New Testament canon, regardless of how it came about. What is significant about the New Testament is that it ends its relative silence about Jesus when he is baptized and begins his ministry. The accounts of the gospel writers resound with the 3.5 years of Jesus' teachings. This may be because that period coincides with the time that the disciples knew him and walked with him. The Nativity and Luke's temple visit stories were likely recounted by Jesus or later by Mary, his mother, after Jesus' death and resurrection. Interestingly, though, although John took in Mary at Jesus' request, it was the Gospels of Matthew and Luke, and not the Gospel of John, that gave us anything about Jesus before his ministry began, including the Nativity. If Mary was the source of this information, and she was living with John, that seems unusual. Perhaps Jesus placed a veil of silence over his past, and Mary continued to honor that. Another possibility for the source could be Elizabeth, who figures prominently in Luke's Gospel for the Nativity, and could also be the source of the story of the Passover visit to Jerusalem. Extended families often travel together for festivals. Even today, we have special holidays where those in the extended family circle are made a part of the celebration. This could explain John's silence about both the Nativity and Jesus' childhood, although it does not necessarily explain Mark's. His gospel, deemed to be the earliest written, simply may not have had access to the information contained in Matthew and Luke, which may argue strongly for someone other than Jesus as a source of the information. So where do we go with all of this? We can understand that in looking at the Gospels, it is important to not let details obscure the general concepts presented. More notably than anywhere else in the Bible other than the book of Revelation, Jesus' teachings present a dualistic view of the universe and therefore a parallel understanding to the perspective of modern Christianity. The universe is divided over a struggle between good and evil, And that struggle, which began in heaven, is now fought also on earth. Humans, for their part, are taking sides in this cosmic battle. Those who side with Jesus Christ do so voluntarily, while those who do not follow Christ are conscripts of his adversary, the devil. There is no neutral ground. Pretending the battle does not concern us, or that it does not exist, prove as futile as a proverbial ostrich hiding its head in the sand. It is little different than modern conflicts, where tens of thousands of innocent people die during conflicts they tried to avoid. The controversy is the ultimate source of every conflict portrayed in literature and art. Every historical battle fought is a living representation of what took place long ago in heaven. We may deny that such a conflict exists, but conflict seems to have become definitive of who we are. For all our desire for peace and an end to conflict, it eludes us, and we seem unable to come to grips with why. The Gospels attempt to address that, especially in the Sermon on the Mount recorded by Matthew. Selfishness is what Jesus saw as the foundation of conflict. We want what we do not have and are far too willing to diminish others to have it. Put simply, we would rather see ourselves own an expensive newer car or a large beautiful home in an upscale neighborhood, maybe even a huge place with acreage in the country, than to see the hungry fed, the oppressed set free, or the naked clothed. When we have more, we do all we can to secure it from those who have less, instead of building bigger tables that the poor may seat themselves and partake. Such selfishness is completely at odds with the principle of giving shared by Jesus, who said that if we are sued for the shirt off our back, we should give our coat as well. Our nature is to grasp tightly what we consider ours, and only releasing it when our hands are cold and dead. We also can see in this the root of struggle in life. We work hard so we can have things that we may not need, but want. Then we work continually to cover the maintenance involved. The house, the cars, and the boat all need insurance, maintenance, registration, and updating. Instead of working to have these things, we can get to the point where we are working for these things. Like the lifeless idols that our ancestors placated with precious offerings and food that could have helped the poor, we offer up hours, days, weeks, months, and years of our lives laboring to maintain these modern deaf and dumb idols. Sadly, as Job learned, no matter how much we accumulate through those years of effort, it can all be swept away in an instant. What profit is it to us then if we enroll in the selfish side of this controversy, only to lose everything after many years? Do we simply begin again, knowing there are not enough years left of our lives to achieve our goal? At what point is it enough? Even more importantly, what does our example say to others? When we own that big, beautiful home on the hill, what does that tell others? Isn't it a testimony that wealth should be the focus of life? And if they have no legal means to achieve that wealth, does it place before them a temptation to do evil to have it? Don't we see that played out in the poor slums in our cities, where drug dealing and the illusion of wealth it brings with it are seen as answers to the grinding poverty in those neighborhoods? When I was 21, I spent far too much money on a Porsche 911T. It took most of my military paycheck each month to make the payments on the luxury sports car. That Christmas, I went door to door with my church on the annual ingathering campaign, seeking donations for the poor. As we tallied up the receipts each evening, I began to realize that I was spending more on that car than we would raise for the entire campaign. The Holy Spirit was convicting me over this, and I felt my face flush with shame. This, coupled with the fact that the car created a never-ending temptation to flaunt the rules of the road, brought me to trade the Porsche in for a much more sensible and frugal vehicle. I would like to say that doing that solved all the poverty in the world, but of course it did not. However, it did free up more of my income so that I was able to contribute more to the solution and be less a part of the problem. We all need only to become aware that our blessings are given to us to be a blessing to others who have not been so blessed. Putting money into the coffers to build big, beautiful churches may only institutionalize the same selfishness we have on an individual level, for it does little to help the poor while helping us to feel prosperous and successful as a denomination. We could all do with a little consideration of whose side we are endorsing in the great controversy between good and evil by how we are ordering our priorities. Thank you for listening to this commentary podcast. You can find the written version of this commentary, along with hundreds more commentaries and podcasts, at our website at www.visitstillwaters.com. You can also find links to books written by the author, as well as further articles written by the author. Once again, that's www.visitstillwaters.com. May God richly bless you and your family.